provides the connection, but it also allows for the separation. That's the perfect balance for him, I think.
They watched the landscape, sitting side by side. An Odeon went past, a cooling tower, and someone running up to bowl. And none thought of the others they would never meet, or how their lives would all contain this hour.
Time and life passing, other places, elsewhere. The images caught from the train in the Whitsun weddings, temporal visual signals caught verbally, kept from oblivion for their own sake, transmitted and then absorbed by interior silence, set against the noise the weddings make, an uncle shouting smut, and behind it all, shuffling gouts of steam, present but mostly implicit, the noise of a railway journey.
And as we raced across bright knots of rail, past standing pullmans, walls of blackened moss came close, and it was nearly done, this frail travelling coincidence. And what it held stood ready to be loosed with all the power that being changed can give. We slowed again, and as the tightened brakes took hold, there swelled a sense of falling, like an arrow shower sent out of sight, somewhere becoming rain.
When you start to think about it, and it's something that is rather important to start to think about, I think, we realise that there are really a lot of Larkin poems that are to do with hearing in one way or another. And another of the poems that is about listening is this poem called Reference Back, which he wrote remembering a visit that he made to his mum and playing old jazz records.
That was a pretty one. I heard you call from the unsatisfactory hall to the unsatisfactory room where I played record after record, idly, wasting my time at home that you looked so much forward to. Oliver's Riverside Blues, it was. And now I shall, I suppose, always remember how the flock of notes those antique Negroes blew out of Chicago air into a huge, remembering, pre-electric horn the year after I was born, 3 decades later, made this sudden bridge from your unsatisfactory age to my unsatisfactory prime.
I think Reference Back is one of Larkin's very, very best poems, and I think that extraordinary last verse is something that Wordsworth would have been proud to see that he'd written in the prelude. It has that kind of grand philosophical utterance, and to make room for that and to get there so fast in a poem of this length is really extraordinary, I think. I think it's very telling that it depends on an act of listening. It's not precisely to do with radio, but it is to do with the auditory imagination.
The next poem, Broadcast, seems to be about as near as I get in this collection to a love poem. It's not, I'm afraid, very near.
The fleeting signals and the pictures they suggest come into focus in another poem about Maeve Brennan, written in 1961, a poem thoroughly fitting to hear Larkin read before we return to this evening's concert. In Broadcast, he is himself listening to the radio, to a live transmission of a concert. For Andrew Motion, it's a poignant poem, full of the separation and yet connection between Larkin and Maeve, knowing she's there, an anonymous part of the audience, somewhere in that distant hall.
Broadcast is the poem of his that, as it were, has most to say about the radio and the sort of connections that radio can make. I think it is a poem of tremendous tenderness, I must say. So even if it isn't quite a 100% love poem, it's certainly a very tender poem. But once again, it's a poem which both regrets the lack of actual involvement with the person being commemorated in the poem, but at the same time relishes that distance. It enjoys the imaginative purchase, which he's able to have by not being involved in the scene in a more direct way.
Giant whispering and coughing from vast sandy full and organ frowned on spaces precede a sudden scuttle on the drum, the queen and huge resettling. Then begins a snivel on the violins. I think of your face among all those faces, beautiful and devout before cascades of monumental slithering, one of your gloves unnoticed on the floor beside those new, slightly outmoded shoes. Here it goes quickly dark. I lose all but the outline of the still and withering leaves on half-empty trees. Behind the glowing wave bends, rabid storms of cording, by being distant, overpower my mind all the more shamelessly. Their cut-off shout, leaving me desperate to pick out your hands, tiny in all that air, applauding.
Philip Larkin reading his poem Broadcast. Telling Me of Elsewhere, Philip Larkin and the Radio was presented by Sean Street and produced by Julian May. Well, if you, like Philip Larkin, are listening to this BBC Prom live here on BBC Radio 3 tonight and are inspired to write a poem about some of the music you're hearing, then do enter the Prom's poetry competition. There are complete details and also terms and conditions online. And if you can condense what you have to say about the music into 140 characters and want to join the conversation on Twitter, make sure you use the hashtag BBCProms. Plenty of messages coming in, like Matthew Lynch on Twitter, who says, Stephen Osborne, stunning in all respects. What a superb encore. Stephen Osborne played the Grieg Piano Concerto and then went on to play his own arrangement of Schumann's Widmung, which some of you were asking about. Well, the second half of the first of tonight's two proms contains two symphonies, another from Sibelius, his third, and first of all, the UK premiere of the Seventh Symphony from Per Nørgaard. Now, after the prom, you'll be able to hear more about his music from Ivan Hewitt and Andrew McGregor. It's interesting to hear Per Nørgaard's music alongside Sibelius, because according to tonight's conductor, John Sturgaard, Sibelius has been quite a big influence on him. And he also suggested to me that Nørgaard is following a similar journey in his symphonies as the Finnish master, in the sense that each symphony inhabits a new world, it does something different. Nørgaard, in fact, currently working on and close to completing his Eighth Symphony, which John Sturgaard is due to conduct the first performance of. The Seventh, that we're about to hear the BBC Philharmonic play, was finished in 2009. He wrote it for the grand opening of the new home of the Danish Radio Symphony Orchestra, the Koncerthuset in Copenhagen. It's that impressive glass and light-filled building that juts out towards the water. The opening, somehow reminiscent of Sibelius, a huge sweep of crystalline sound, and then the rhythm takes over. Per Nørgaard Symphony No. 7 gets its UK premiere now at the Proms.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
the Danish composer Per Nørgaard's 7th Symphony getting its UK premiere live here at the BBC Proms. The BBC Philharmonic, conducted by their principal guest conductor, John Sturgard. Totally engrossed in Per Nørgaard's Symphony No. 7, mesmerising, said Alice Bolton on Twitter. Couple of your other reactions to that. Liking this symphony from Nørgaard in the BBC Proms, says Stephen, but would like tips on how to pronounce him properly. Well, Per Nørgaard is about the best that I can do. If you can do better than that, do let me know. Using the hashtag BBC Proms on Twitter. The whole BBC Philharmonic on their feet now, with their leader Yuri Tuchinsky and the conductor, John Sturgard, who's shortly to conduct the premiere of Per Nørgaard's 8th Symphony, which is on its way. Well, there's more of Per Nørgaard's music later in a Proms composer portrait with Angie McGregor in conversation with Ivan Hewitt. That's coming up after the end of this concert and before the start of tonight's late night prom, in which we're delving into the sound world, completely different to this one, of Ivor Novello. Well, Per Nørgaard much admired Sibelius. I had a lovely story from Andrew McGregor earlier on today about a teenage Nørgaard who was listening to the radio and he heard Sibelius's 2nd Symphony and he was so blown away by it that he wrote to Sibelius and he also sent him his Opus 1 and apparently Sibelius wrote back to him. The two of them never actually met, although they were once in a room, but Per Nørgaard was far too scared to go up and talk to Sibelius. Well, the programme ends with Sibelius, his 3rd symphony, and to tell us a bit about it, here's tonight's conductor, John Sturgard.
The 3rd, I think, is really something new for its time, and very little related to what he had done symphonically before that. A work full of surprises, I guess, for the listener who doesn't know it still. And also, it's a very adventurous, exciting process. Even if the main key is C major, and somebody could expect that, how can you make something exciting and interesting and wild of so much C major? But he really does. And also, I think some of the most modern music he ever wrote is in the 3rd symphony. There are some really wild kind of modern elements in that piece, especially in the beginning of the last movement, which he also said himself that this has to be like chaos, and then little by little going into the final C major euphoria. From that on, he was really not the same Sibelius as he was before.
Tonight's conductor here at the BBC Proms, John Sturgard, who's the chief principal guest conductor of the BBC Philharmonic. He's been working with them for about a year. It's his first appearance with them at the BBC Proms. Well, he's talking about the piece that we're going to hear next, Sibelius's 3rd Symphony. Tom Service has done a Proms music guide about the piece as well, which you can download from the Proms and Radio 3 websites. Just go to bbc.co.uk/radio3, follow the links to podcasts. In that, Tom Service describes the final movement in terms of Einstein's theory of relativity. The faster you go, the slower you get, essentially. It is an extraordinary crescendo to a rather extraordinary work. Well, the orchestra and John Sturgard are going to be flying off to Lapland tomorrow. They're going on a bit of a Finnish tour. And they're going to be playing football against John Sturgard's own orchestra, the Lapland Chamber Orchestra. He apparently is going to be in goal for the Lapland Chamber Orchestra. Before that, though, he's making his way onto the stage of the Albert Hall to the podium, perhaps a slightly safer spot for him, to conduct Sibelius's Symphony No. 3.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
triumphant and also a depiction of chaos in Sibelius's own words. His third symphony, performed live here at the BBC Proms by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by their principal guest conductor, John Sturgard, the Finnish conductor. Playing to a packed Royal Albert Hall here. They've managed to pack three symphonies into the first of tonight's two proms. Pretty impressive stuff. As I mentioned earlier, they're off on tour now to Lapland. Meanwhile, the Halle Orchestra is backstage preparing for the late night prom tonight, the Ivor Novello celebrations, joined by soprano Sophie Bevan, tenor Toby Spence, and Simon Callow. John Sturgill's returning to the stage now, applauding the BBC Philharmonic and bringing them to their feet, but they refuse in his honour. And now they rise to their feet with him. Well, it's been very much a Nordic night here at the Proms so far. For Usain Bolt winning gold in the 200 metres, it's been, I think, a rather glorious night. And it's about to become a glamorous night at 10:15 with the start of the Ivor Novello Prom. Before that, we've a chance to hear more music by the Danish composer Per Nørgaard, whose Seventh Symphony we just heard. For that, I'm going to hand you on to James Jolly in Broadcasting House. Good night.
Thanks, Sarah. That was Sarah Moore-Peach. And there's another chance to hear that prom on Tuesday week, the 21st of August at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. As Sarah said, we return to the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom at 10:15. And before that, at 9:30, we've our prom's composer portrait.
Life for young Europeans.
If you are caught sleeping in a public place, then you can be fined or you can go to prison. Basically, poverty is criminalized if you're homeless.
A generation fighting draconian legislation, rising poverty and corruption.
He's young, he's inexperienced, but that's a good thing because he's inexperienced in politics, he doesn't know how to steal.
BBC Radio 4 spends a week with Generation E, starting next Monday at 1:45.
Well, we've a little time in hand, or a moment or two in her time in hand, before the prom's composer portrait. So I thought we'd stay in Northern Europe for a piano miniature, a lyric piece by Grieg. Here's Andrei Gavrilov.
Thank you.
Summer's Eve by Grieg, played by Andrei Gavrilov. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Now it's 9:30 and we've our Proms composer portrait recorded earlier at the Royal College of Music. Here's Andrew McGregor.
Welcome to the Concert Hall of the Royal College of Music. We're going to be discovering a great deal more about the man behind the Seventh Symphony, given its UK premiere in this evening's prom, Danish composer Pierre Neergaard. Now, usually I'd be sitting here with the composer himself. That's how these portraits work. But we know that there's a degree of optimism involved in asking Pierre to join us today. He just turned 80, and his age and rheumatism make it increasingly difficult to leave home for this kind of celebration of his music. He's sorry he couldn't join us himself, but writer, broadcaster and contemporary music enthusiast Ivan Hewitt is here with me, and so are the students from the Royal Northern College of Music who've been preparing Neergaard's Dances Around Jupiter and his sixth quartet, Tintinnabulary, for us to hear. So it may be a little less of a self-portrait than we normally have, but there's no reason why we shouldn't achieve a good likeness. Now, Ivan, you've met Pierre Neergaard several times. Give us an idea of what the man's like physically to meet him. How does he come across?
Well, he's very tall, for one thing. You have to look up to Pierre in more than one sense. And he's like a sort of tall Viking, really. You know, he's very blonde. There's a short story of D.H. Lawrence where Lawrence talks about a character as being like a piece of the outdoors come indoors. And that's what Pierre Neergaard is like. You know, you'd imagine him in his seven-league boots striding over a Danish hill somewhere. And he's also very charming and extraordinarily courteous. That's the other thing about the man. He's got this old-world courtesy, which we will, in fact, hear later.
And I read about Pierre in his early years as a child and as a student being rather shy and a little withdrawn, which seems to be characteristics which came through he developed as a composer. Is that still something you're aware of when you meet him?
Well, he's somebody who lives very much in his own world. Shy, I think, wouldn't be quite the right word now, but certainly very self-contained. It's very hard to imagine Pierre Neergaard doing anything for publicity's sake, you know? A feature of his childhood was that he was very interested in theatre. He used to build little theatres and make little models of characters and invent fantastical dramatic scenes, rather like Ligeti, actually. And it took him a while to discover that music was going to be his real talent.
Because he'd make mini musicals, wouldn't he, and draw cartoons for them as well.
He would. He was very ambitious as a child. You know, it would be the complete show he'd present, you know. And, of course, he has kept his flair for music theatre since. You know, there are operas and music theatre pieces in his catalogue.
And what about early musical background? Because I suppose, well, growing up in Denmark from the 30s through to the 50s, he was musically Scandinavian first, wasn't he? Or Nordic, rather than European by instinct.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. He has always said that he's a great admirer of Carl Nielsen, particularly, and the most eminent follower also of Carl Nielsen, who was a man called Wagner Holmbo, who Nielsen studied with. Neergaard himself describes his music of those days, the 50s, as completely wild, and he was amazed that Wagner Holmbo took him on. But he did, and in fact became his favoured pupil, in fact, and Neergaard was called upon to finish unfinished works of Holmbo. And his early works do show a kind of Sibelius-like fascination with musical processes which are organic and unending and don't seem to aim at an emphatic end point and have a suggestion of illimitable horizons and a strange kind of, I know it sounds a slightly cliche thing to say, but they do have a kind of Nordic light to them, you know, a kind of cool intensity.
It's interesting hearing you say that because I read him disagreeing with the idea that Sibelius is in some way about nature, the way he writes music. I mean, what did he say? It's that the music works in the same way that nature does, but it's not actually about nature.
Yes, now that's a very interesting distinction. I think Neergaard is somewhat like John Cage, interestingly, with whom he has nothing else in common, really, in the sense that he's not interested in how nature looks and sounds. You know, he's not interested in making attractive portraits of landscapes, for example. What fascinates him is the mechanisms that underlie the visual appearance of nature, like mathematical processes, like the processes of growth. He's really in love with self-generating processes like the Fibonacci series of numbers, you know, which multiplies itself endlessly. And he's interested in nature from the molecular level to the cosmic, I think it's true to say. It's not just the landscape that interests him, it's the wheeling of the spheres and down to the molecular level.
And we are certainly going to be hearing elements of that in the two chamber works we have. And it's interesting hearing what Nurgor himself picks up on to talk about in his own music, because we will be hearing from him as part of this composer portrait, because he recorded some reflections on the way his Seventh Symphony works, especially for us, and he made these recordings only yesterday so that we could hear them ourselves. Here he is, just for us.
Hello. It's a pleasure for me to give a very short introduction to my Seventh Symphony, which is very characterized in the first movement by small drums, 14 in number, going downwards like this. Boom, 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 beep, beep, boom, boom. Movement having this bright character. I was very fascinated of the uncertainty of when does the next boom come. And that is into the contrast of second movement, a very simple little melody. And then suddenly interrupted by an enormous C major chord. It's like all the movement has this very forceful start and then it's dying out. Last movement goes on, in fact, where first movement ended, as if we have cut some part of the first movement, ending noch einmal, as the German says, we would say, still you would hear this boom, 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 and that finishes the work. Thank you for your attention.
It's almost as if he was here with us, isn't
Indeed.
It?
Indeed. What a shame.
Pierre Nurgor sending us some reflections on the Seventh Symphony, given its UK premiere in this evening's prompt. So, Ivan, how much are we going to hear of those kinds of elements in the chamber music that's ahead of us? Rhythmically, there's some very interesting things happening.
There are, indeed. I mean, I should say first, we'll hear quite a lot of C major, in fact, because both pieces are somewhat obsessed with it. They keep returning to it. And when you hear that bottom C, of course, in the string quartet, it's a bottom C string, so it has a nice resonant twang to it. In the saxophone quartet, it makes a pretty good fruity noise as well, I must say. And one feels it as a kind of tonal center, but not in the sense of a grammatically tonal center. It feels almost as if the music is rooted in it in the way that a natural phenomenon is rooted in its fundamental vibration. I suppose that's the metaphor to conjure it. You asked about the rhythm. There is certainly quite a strong reminiscence of that little drum, descending drum figure in the quartet. It seems to be a characteristic of his more recent music that he wants to conjure up. I mean, the way I read it is that he's looking for a horizontal equivalent, a temporal expression, of the kind of non-harmonic, the kind of irregular partials, upper partials that you hear in things like bell sounds. And of course, that quartet is called Tintinabulary, and it is very obsessed with bells.
Well, we don't get an explicit program for the work. You wouldn't expect it with Pianeta, would you?
Absolutely not.
But he does write something to introduce the score. He says the bell-like association of the title reflects the special texture of the work, like the changing overtones of a struck, resonating bell. The four instruments are unified in a single line, which is broken up in a multitude of changing dynamics and rhythmic patterns. And we have lots of those harmonics ringing against each other, don't we? And the rhythmic layers are fascinating as well, layer upon layer, and changes of speed, doublings, quadruplings of speed.
Yes, on the page it looks pretty fearsome. To listen to it, I think it's not so fearsome. And the reason for that, I think the thing that separates Nergal from people who share some of these interests, like Stockhausen, for example, is that Nergal never loses his attachment to things which are rooted in music's culture. And I think he's interested in bringing together things which come out of the natural world, like these sequences of non-harmonic partials, with things that are very reminiscent of the human musical world. And so, for example, there's a I think quite a funny moment in this quartet where a tangle of descending lines, which itself prompts the rooted sea to skitter about in a slightly scherzo-like way, is suddenly brought to an abrupt halt by what sounds like a really old-fashioned perfect cadence. It's like the kind of cadence you get at the end of a hymn, da-dum. And it happens at top speed, and it is just thrown into the texture so fast that you could miss it. And it's a kind of little joke, I think. And there are little jokes dropped into the music quite often.
Well, let's hear it. To perform Pierre Nergal's Tintinabulary, his sixth string quartet, please welcome our four string players from the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester. Violinists Chien Wu and Edward Brenton, viola player Matthew Kettle, and cellist Joe Zeitlin.
Thank you. Thank you.